Today I'm talking with Geordie Willis, creative director and education director at Berry Brothers & Rudd, one of the oldest wine and spirits merchants in the world. What I'm interested really in is about you and how you got to the business, because I know that your history in work has been quite diverse.
So it's, first of all, it's probably interesting to say that it's quite unusual for a wine business to have a creative director. And the question I get more often than anything else is why would a wine business need it? It's completely understandable in a fashion business or in a furniture business. But I think as creative director, I think of it as much about creative thinking as much as the creative manifestation of the brand. But my background was magazines. So I worked in NatMags, which became Hearst, working for Harper's Bazaar and Esquire. And I was in a creative agency for a long time as well, but also working here at the weekends because magazines were so badly paid back in those days that actually just having a little bit of extra pocket money was important. So my role is creative director, but it's fairly multifaceted. So I look after things like property here in St. James's in London. I look after physical retail here in St. James's, and I look after hospitality, which we bundle up into brand experiences. So it's really how the brand manifests itself across every single touch point in the business.
I mean, I was actually going to ask you about the creative director role, because it is unusual. You're associated much more with the creative agency, advertising agency, marketing, fashion.
Yeah.
So on a day-to-day, basis, what is your creative director role?
Yeah. So I think that there are different ways that it manifests itself. For example, we have always, as a business, been content creators. So, for example, we invented the first ever wine magazine back in 1954, and we still have a magazine today. So it might be art direction on a magazine. It might be the spaces that we have around us. So we have 12 buildings here in St. James's. We have a fairly large estate, and that estate is broadly very customer facing. Most recently, that been delivered through, for example, a new shop on the corner of St. James's Street, a new spirit shop that we've just opened. So the way that the property evolves is very much part of my world. But also, I suppose, the way that we interact with customers, whether that be through events, both in the building, but also outside the building, the way that the brand appears within print, online, social media. I think all businesses now interact with customers on so many different platforms that actually I would almost encourage more businesses to think about having someone who has creative responsibility. It doesn't necessarily need to be a job in its own right, but someone who is accountable and responsible will help provide that consistency that I think any brand needs.
So within that world of creative directorship, I mean, are you looking at the packaging as well as the experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose my first creative director role coming back here in 2012, I was based in Hong Kong before that, was working with Pentagram, a creative agency, to look at a rebrand. Well, I suppose actually it was probably more a brand evolution rather than a revolution, but it was taking what had existed by that point for almost 315 years and start to extract and create or recreate a brand that had almost too much in the archive. It was sort of selective storytelling in so many ways. And we went through this process of brand archaeology to help define the brand or what it could be. John Rudd, who was our chairman at the time, John died a few years ago now, but he said, it was a wonderful brief because he said, you can do whatever you like as long as you don't change the color or the logo. And I said, well, that's not ideal. That makes it a bit tricky. But actually at the time as a business, we were using about 20 different logos around the building. If you walked to the shop, the outside was this rather sludgy green. The vans were dark blue, the bags were white. So there was a piece about consistency and bringing the brand back together. So that, of course, encompassed packaging and also labeling as well. Whilst we are broadly purveyors of other people's goods, we also have wines under our own label. And of course, the bag, as is so often with merchants or retailers, even though we're selling other people's stuff, the bag means a huge amount to people. So, for example, I went to a dinner party the other day and someone turned up with a Berry Brothers bag, and I was surprised to see that the bottle wasn't one of ours. And I didn't say anything at the time, but I did say to someone afterwards, I said, that bottle wasn't bought from us. And they said, ah, we've seen that before. Sometimes people will keep the bag because it gives a different meaning to the present. So, you know, the whole packaged experience is important to our customers.
And that's an interesting luxury question.
Very interesting luxury question. Now, does the bag mean more than the product?
Yeah.
Hopefully not. I think we would stand up to the fact that the packaging and the presentation should enhance the product, but it shouldn't take the place of the quality of the product itself.
Sure. But you do often see people carrying shopping bags from other, absolutely, you know, luxury brands, though they might not have bought anything in the store.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And interestingly, that idea of visibility through colour, you know, whether it's the Tiffany's blue or the Hermes orange or what have you, our colour, which is a very dark green. The reason we came about that is because the shop, and if any of your listeners know the shop, is this rather sort of Dickensian shop front with this bubbled, warped paint on the outside. Because for many, many years, we just painted over it. And to get that color, we found that the best way of doing it was to take a syringe and to extract paint pigment from the many layers of paint. And we went back to the 1920s, which is where the logo came from, which is this wonderful sans serif typeface, very modern typeface in the 1920s and still quite contemporary today. And we were able to match the color identically to the pigment that was representing the brand in the 1920s. So that sort of depth of detail and interest and craft in the brand has been a sort of fun. There are lots of layers to it, like the shop front, there are lots of layers to the brand.
Oh, it's interesting. You talk about the 20s and pigment and paint and all of these things that it's a patina, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder how, I mean, you've got history that dates back to the 17th century.
Yeah.
How important is that in maintaining this, well, a perception of purveyors of luxury wine and spirits?
I think longevity is a shortcut to trust. I think that as a business, we have been evolving for three centuries now, but I think the fact that we've been around for a long time, we're lucky enough to have royal warrants as well, which is another indicator of quality, I suppose. More relevant to different audiences perhaps, but certainly something we're very proud of. And I think that the main thing for any heritage brand, and I would consider ourselves a luxury heritage brand, is that you don't spend too much time obsessing about the past. My grandfather, who was chairman for 20 years here, he would say that you have to be careful. If you're spending too much time looking over your shoulder at the past, you tend to bump into the future. And I think there are many merchants and other businesses that have been wonderful businesses that have fallen by the wayside over the years because they've been too interested in their illustrious stories rather than necessarily where they're going.
Yeah. And you mentioned your own product, own label product.
Yeah.
How far back does that stretch?
Well, I suppose we've been bottling wine for producers for many, many years. The role of the merchant was always to select the very finest goods from around the world. But for example, on the spirit side, we have been independent bottlers for, you know, over 100 years now. That idea of curating, which I think many luxury brands do, you know, finding the very best and bringing it back to a central location, has been something that we've done for, I suppose, depending on how you look at it, for certainly over a century.
Wow.
Yeah.
Within the luxury brand market, and I know you've referred to luxury brands a few times, and they're two questions in which are going to evolve from this. One is, what do you consider yourself a luxury brand or purveyors of luxury goods? Mm-hmm. And do you see a distinction in that? And often when companies produce goods under their own label, they seem today, at least, to be cheaper, but obviously, you know, or of lesser quality, but more affordable. But in this instance, that's probably the opposite.
So let's two very good questions, but I'm gonna unpack it a little bit. So I think that as purveyors of other people's goods, you are often falling into the trap is perhaps the wrong word, but we are probably a luxury brand without a luxury margin. You know, I think you get your luxury margin through having a integrated supply chain, and we don't do that by and large. We sell other people's goods. So the challenge to a business like us is that we have to take that quite small margin compared to a lot of luxury brands that you would see up, you know, Fifth Avenue or Bond Street. And we have to be really selective and clever with how we reinvest some of that margin back into the luxury experience. Whether or not we're luxury, I think, is probably in the minds of the customer rather than us. We don't necessarily get a price premium because we're selling often the same things as our competitors might be down the road or across the road. And wine is an interesting market like that. However, I do think that people will put a degree of trust in us, that if we are presenting a bottle that perhaps you might not have heard of, the fact that we are endorsing it in some way probably would expedite a sale in a way that might not happen if you were buying elsewhere. So trust is a hugely important part. In terms of the entry point, it's a really interesting question, because what we're not, I suppose, doing as a brand is using the brand as an opportunity for a diffusion line. And we've seen that, of course, across many fashion brands. What we are in a position to do, and this is a strength, is because we have, I suppose, two customers. We have the end consumer and we also have the producer. So we think of ourselves as being the almost the closest link between those who make it and those who drink it. Because you have a vantage position in both directions, if you look at our own label products, they will often talk about the person who's making the wine as well. And I think that often what you have with diffusion lines is you are, dare I say, profiteering from the brand to sell something at an entry point, whether it be sunglasses or lipstick or whatever it might be. For us, we see it as an opportunity to champion some of the producers that we have very long-standing relationships with. And even on the own selection wines, for example, the Berry Brothers logo, which is flanked by two Royal Warrants, doesn't sit at the top of the label, it sits at the bottom, because it's very much an endorsement rather than necessarily a brand in its own right. Mm. So there's an interesting dynamic between brand and product there. But
so, and that's why I'm interested in these conversations, because I often find that where you've got these subtle nuances in language, it has a significant impact on the perception of a product or service.
Yeah.
So in the, you know, where you speak of, you know, supporting, you know, other suppliers, a brand typically wouldn't.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked you the question, if you're a purveyor of luxury goods or a brand.
It's, and the dynamic between the producers is that often the producers that we're representing are luxury brands in their own right. So if you look at Bordeaux or Burgundy, for example, two of the most well-known wine regions in the world, some of those top wines are really household names, you know, the Chateau Lafite's, the O'Briens, the Latours, and so on. Some of them are even owned by luxury powerhouses now. Yeah. And consequently, when we are selling those products in their own right, it's probably no different the way that a Harrods or a Selfridges or a Fortnum & Mason's would sell the brands that they have curated and represent. I suppose the difference for us is, whereas some of those retailers wouldn't necessarily have that depth of producer information on their own label product, and perhaps it's where they see the opportunity for margin and opportunity there. For us, we really want to champion those relationships because we have some extremely well thought of producers who are happy to co-brand products, which is something that we see a mutual and symbiotic benefit on both sides.
Yeah, and I think that's really important.
Mm.
And I think that's where this distinction between luxury, it probably needs to exist.
Mm.
Because what we see more and more, or especially over the past probably 20 years, 30 years, you know, we used to have designer labels.
Yeah.
Those designer labels don't exist anymore. They're luxury brands.
Yeah.
Those luxury brands are producing as within a fashion cycle, but companies like yours don't necessarily interact in that same way, because it's not as much about fashion and a cycle. Mm. It's more about, I'm making an assumption here, but it's more about the product and you know, this idea of heritage and the quality of the ingredients, and you were speaking earlier about experience, all those things. It seems to me quite a different experience from a global retailer selling, you know, fashion goods.
I think fashion, there are lots of quite interesting parallels with the wine world and the fashion world. We talk about the importance of designers in the fashion world. We talk about the importance of producers in the wine world. You sometimes even have super producers changing vineyards and working for someone else. We have vintages in the same way as we have seasons. And we have fashion in the same way that the typical fashion, it's not quite as dynamic as perhaps the fashion world. But you do see things like, for example, there's a classic example of it's rare to drink what your parents drink. You know, we all are, by human nature, rebels. And you will see that if a parent's generation is, let's say, drinking red Bordeaux, the likelihood is that the children might push away from that a little bit and want to be more adventurous. And I think that's very similar to the way that fashion works. Now, equally, things come round and come back in. And I think quality tends to shine through. But you do see things that come through and are fashionable. Yeah. But perhaps you have a little bit more permanence related to quality that that continues regardless to the fashions of the day.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was reading, and I won't name the wine.
Yeah.
I was reading a few articles over the past couple of weeks about a rosé.
Mm.
And apparently, you know, the rosé that everybody was drinking apparently is not the one to drink anymore because there are much better rosés around.
Yeah, you have. I mean, there are certain parts of the wine world which are more fashion orientated. So, let's say champagne traditionally has been very much about brand, in a very positive way. But champagne houses are more likely to be sponsoring luxury events than chateaus, for example. Now, rosé fits into that a little bit because rosé brands are brands in their own right. They often have celebrity owners. They might have more associated brand names rather than chateau. Plume de Matante, they're called something which is more recognisable. Spirits also are perhaps more fashion and brand orientated, and increasingly have opportunities to spend quite significant advertising and promotional sums on promoting and enhancing the brands as well.
Yeah. Speaking of spirits, so Japanese whiskey has become quite popular.
Yeah.
Why is and Taiwanese apparently?
Yeah.
Why has there been this sudden shift in...
So I think there's a natural curiosity when it comes to consumers, and therefore being the first to know about something is always interesting. Taiwan is relatively straightforward in some ways. Now, both nations are making fantastic whiskey for a start. So if we almost put quality to one side, Taiwan... some years ago, a whiskey called Cavalan won an award. It was, I think, a blind tasting, but it won the award for best whiskey in the world. Mm. Now, suddenly that creates a buzz, and it is a tremendously good whiskey. But that gave them a provenance and a position that resonated with a global audience. And Japanese whiskey is interesting because the quality, again, is certainly there. But there is something, I think, where you go into the realm of being less empirical and more... Japanese whiskey feels inherently cool. There's something about it. There's something where it manifests, the label manifests itself in bottle. There's something about it being slightly different. Again, quality put aside, that I think really interests spirits collectors. And spirits collectors, in a way, it's interesting because we have both a wine and a spirit shop. The spirits collectors... perhaps, dare I say, it's a little bit more nerdy. They want that depth of story. They want to spend more time. We even see it in terms of dwell time in store. Spirits collectors will spend more time asking questions, looking, coming back, bringing a friend, and so on. So there is this real sense of curiosity and discovery that comes with spirits. And I think that that sense of travel, of exploration, with a Japanese whiskey or a Taiwanese whiskey or a bourbon from the United States, there's a little bit of armchair travel that comes with that and that breadth of experience and understanding. And I think people recognize that whilst there is wonderful, wonderful whiskey, of course, made in Scotland, and as a Scot, I should be protecting that with all my worth. But at the same time, an avid collector and connoisseur of spirits should have a broader collection than just one particular area of space line, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's also, it's the same with wine. You know, yeah. Some people, I have a friend of mine who's an avid wine drinker, has just come back from Argentina and said, you know, the wine's so underrated.
Yeah.
And in probably better than Australian wine.
Yeah.
It's...
Well, if that, that idea of... So firstly, I'm a great... The reason I'm not a wine buyer for the business, I don't get given the responsibility of buying wine, and mainly because I'm a really soft touch. So if I am in Argentina or Italy or France, wherever it might be, the danger for me is that I'm so taken in by the place that if I'm sitting in Mendoza in Argentina and... I'm being offered a glass of wine by an incredibly captivating winemaker, then I probably, you know, I have an affinity with that wine that I wouldn't have if I just picked it off a supermarket shelf. But there are always going to be regions that are underrated. And that's part of the pleasure and enjoyment of wine is that sense of exploration.
Yeah.
We know that there will be value to be found in places that that other people aren't necessarily looking, and that's the joy of an independent wine store. Is that the great frustration, I suppose, is that if you know an awful lot about wine, buying wine in a supermarket is quite a clever thing to do because supermarkets have fantastic wine buyers now, far greater than it would have been 20, 30 years ago. If you know nothing about wine, then an independent wine merchant is the right place to be. But of course, it's a little bit scary. If you walk into an independent wine merchant for the first time, you can feel a little bit like you're going to be ridiculed, or if you don't know the difference between your Burgundy and your Bordeaux, it's quite daunting. Probably a little bit like walking into a tailor on Savile Row when you've never bought a suit before. So consequently, part of our role is to make sure that whilst we retain that sense of exclusivity and luxury, we also make sure that anyone that walks in is treated in exactly the same way and is looked after. And I love walking into the shop and seeing people say, you know, I'm going to a barbecue on Friday night and I want to spend £25 and I don't know what to buy. Can you help me? Is just as valid a question as someone coming in and saying, can you tell me about the malolactic fermentation and crop yields of this particular vintage and wine?
Yeah.
You know, different courses, different courses.
Yeah, and that's really important. I mean, you speak about experience
yeah.
a lot,
yeah.
and the experience of being, you know, captivated by the environment
yeah.
is as important in some instances as the actual product.
Yeah, yeah. I love, I'm a great believer, and I'm biased here because I look after retail here, but I think that increasingly as the digital world evolves, physical retail needs to evolve with it. And I think that wonderful complementary juxtaposition between physical and digital is what luxury brands need to continue to do well. And we see, for example, a lot of tourists in market here. So a lot of customers coming into the shop for the first time may have heard about us many, many miles away, but have almost made a pilgrimage to come here and to buy wine or spirits here. And I think that sense of exceptional service delivered through physical spaces is something that it's really hard, to my mind at least, to claim a position of a luxury brand without being able to offer a physical luxury experience as well. Whatever that might look like, and it would be different for different brands, of course, but I love seeing customers standing with salespeople or shop teams and interacting and asking questions and doing all of those things that we've been doing for generations.
Yeah, I agree. I think, especially within, you know, the luxury world,
yeah.
the environment is incredibly important.
Yeah,
and you can't buy luxury online.
It's a different experience.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because you know we have a website. We had a very early website. We had a website that launched in 1994, which is very very
early. Yeah.
Sort of Amazon and Google came along after us in some respects. But
it's CompuServe in those days, wasn't it?
CompuServe, yeah. But we recognized at the time that they had to work together. And I suppose in our world, that role of technology is as much about, I suppose, utilizing technology to make us more human. And I think that's sometimes something that brands get wrong. And if you can make that digital experience seamless, and that's often with education, again, I would question if you are buying a beautiful cashmere jumper actually the depth of knowledge you need about that particular item of clothing. Now, it may be satisfying to know, you know, the level of production and where it was made and who made it and so on. However, with wine, there's a narrative that goes with every single product, and it talks of vintages, it talks of families, producers. Most of the winemakers we work with, for example, are family businesses, and they all have individual stories to tell as well.
Yeah, you see, so that, to me, again, I keep going back to this distinction because I suppose my battle is creating those really important distinctions, because yes, you can go into firstly, I think luxury's been consumed by fashion.
Yeah.
And luxury for me is not about fashion.
Yeah,
typically. And I think, you know, speaking about, you know, going into a store buying cashmere jumper, yeah, you might be interested in the ply and where the yarn's from and how it's been plucked or spun or dyed, whatever that might be. But I think, you know, the points you've raised about a farmer, the person, the place, the investment in the production of a wine or a spirit, it does seem to me to be quite different.
There's depth to it.
Yeah.
And there's also, there is a huge variety when it comes to producers. So you might be in, I don't know, in the Napa Valley, and there might be an extraordinary, you know, very high tech, you know, almost James Bond glare of a winery out there producing wonderful, wonderful wine. Or you might be in Burgundy, where a producer is working with their son and their daughter on just a couple of rows of vines and creating something extraordinary. And the difference between the two, from a distance, you wouldn't tell. You're just looking at two bottles. Whereas I think when you start to look at those stories, when you start to understand the work that goes in, and you can't just sub out a producer with someone else because it's cost efficient. You know, we look at representing these producers where often we've represented them for generations. We have great relationships with producers where we're acting not as an official advisor, but there's a constant dialogue and conversation to help us learn, but to help them learn as well. One of the things I love is that if you imagine, let's say we work with 300 producers or thereabouts. If we have a young first generation producer working in the Alsace and they're trying to do something around irrigation that is novel, we might know a producer in California who's been doing it for two generations. So we can then connect those producers together and say, well, you know, is there a mentoring system that could work there? So there is this, almost as a merchant, we are a sort of nexus between these different brands, and we can connect not just through a central location, but we can create these multitude of connections between the producers that we represent. And I don't think that would ever happen necessarily in a traditional retailer. No. Well, why would it, I suppose?
Exactly. But and then that just kind of...
It just reinforces.
Reinforces, exactly.
Reinforces those relationships. And, you know, they're great friendships as well. We have, you know, producers that I look back at, and, you know, I might be sitting in a chateau in Bordeaux, and I know that the grandmother of the wine producer sat in the same room with my grandfather, talking about probably the same topics of whether the weather was looking good and when they were going to be picking the grapes. You know, there's something wonderful about the longevity of winemaking, whilst it's far more technical than perhaps it would have been a generation or two ago. Still, ultimately, it's taking wine or taking grapes and turning them into wine. There is this alchemy that happens in the bottle, which is exactly the same as it was, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah. And that experience, I think, you'd also probably find in the old tailors on Savile Row.
Yeah.
Or maybe Loch next door.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those are the things that I think are incredibly important. I mean, the history, you eighth generation of a family who's been here since 1648 or something.
1698.
Oh,
sounds quite grown up when you say it like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It's, I mean, the family side, I think that family businesses are, I mean, fascinating. We could talk for another 5 hours about family businesses and dynamics. We're very lucky because we have two families.
Yeah.
And I often get asked how do you survive for as long as you have done. And one of the great pleasures for us is because the Rudds, who arrived in the 1920s, we're quite different characters as two families, but we've always worked very closely together and very interconnected, almost like cousins rather than completely separate families. My grandfather's best man was John Rudd. My grandfather's godson was Edward Rudd. You know, there's a lot of cross-pollination there.
Yeah.
But you do make decisions in a different way because the decisions that we're making are taking into consideration future generations. And again, whilst there's great pleasure in looking backwards and celebrating some of the stories of the past, and you know, we hope that we're great storytellers as well as business people, we're constantly thinking about how do you ensure that a business like ours doesn't just survive for another 325 years, but how do you thrive for 325 years? And in many ways, the way I look at the business now, and part of my role is about new ventures as well, is how do you behave like a 325-year-old startup? And that dynamic of trying new things, knowing where to be brave, knowing where you need to hunker down, all of that, if we kept on doing what we did when we started, we started the business as a coffee merchant.
Yeah.
So evolution and change is very much part of our nature. And the only way a business like ours remains relevant for over three centuries is by constant change and adapting. And someone asked me during the pandemic, you know, how do you deal with something like a pandemic? And I said, well, if we go back to the origins of the business, we were only 30 years after the plague. You know, the London in 1665 was I said, that was in a generation of understanding these things. So you do oscillate with wars, pandemics, famines, you know, the world, what was it Mark Twain said, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Yeah. You know, you have learnings there. And if we can take those learnings into the future, then I think we're probably in a good position.
You mentioned the internet, 1994. How has technology impacted on the way you operate?
I think it continues to impact us in a positive sense. I think that the bit that we are spending a lot of time on at the moment, which sounds a little bit late, but I don't think it is about CRM, so the way we look after our customers. If we go back 100 years, we had fewer customers and therefore knowing them well was something that was almost intuitive as a business. Nowadays we have hundreds of thousands of customers, and therefore how do you know customers as well as you want to, and all of those nuances of what they like, what they don't like. So CRM is hugely important. I think interestingly AI, which is obviously a hot topic for everyone, will play a considerable part in the wine world. I think there's opportunities on two levels to tell people what to do and what to buy, or help them. And some of those really subtle nuances of your buying habits. So now you may say, well, I know what I like, but that doesn't necessarily make me an expert. If you take what you like and you map it against what other people like, let's say that you and I had a very similar cellar and we had 10 cases and three of those cases were the same and another two cases were quite similar. We might be able to suggest that we had quite similar taste. Now, if I can then put a wine in front of you and say that someone very similar to your profile really enjoyed this wine, you might be able to say, well, actually, that's probably quite likely to be the case. So I think that AI is going to impact everyone, but I think there are lots of very positive impacts in the wine world and in our world in terms of how we look after customers in that respect. But to really ensure for us as much as anything else is that, you know, we have customers in almost 100 countries around the world, but our offices are Hong Kong, Tokyo, Singapore, and London. The internet allows us to tell those rich stories in multiple regions and to look after customers who may never make it to St. James's Street. Those opportunities to tell stories, we're in this wonderful pine paneled room at the moment, and actually being able to see that online or hear about it on a podcast or be able to tell that story through our magazine or whatever it might be, those are great opportunities for people to engage with us in a way that you simply can't if you don't have that sort of digital omnipresence.
Yeah. And I mean, that's partly why we thought that for this new season, we'd, you know, go to the place.
Yeah.
Because like you said, this is even, you know, for us, it's a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
You know, you're going somewhere which is amazing, seeped in history. That epitomizes this idea of preservation, you know, business,
yeah,
all those things that are probably more important today, where so many companies are struggling, you know, fashion's changing, people's tastes changing, but this is, you know.
There's a permanence to it.
Yeah.
And again, that comes back to trust. But I also think that what I feel very precious about is that this space is, it's more of a theatre than a museum. I think that if it's not used, interestingly, during lockdown, I lived for about 6 months above the shop here, which sounds wonderful. It sounds like a real treat. I didn't drink for 6 months
right.
Because I thought it was a good opportunity to have a bit of time off. So I was sitting above one of the greatest collections of wine in the world and without a corkscrew, which was probably a waste.
Right.
But what was interesting walking around the building here was how much it started to creak. And what I realized is that actually it's the interaction between humans and place that keep it alive.
Yeah.
And it would be very easy for us to put a velvet rope in front of the door here and say that no one is to come into these spaces. You can look in, but you can't necessarily use it.
Mm.
But it's the oars on your hands on the banister. It's the constant walking across the floorboards that give that sense of patina and that idea of creating spaces that wear in rather than wear out. When we create new spaces now, we always build in a way that we want them to look better in 10 years rather than look worn out in 10 years. Mm. So for example, with the shop around the corner, the floor is 6 tons of oak. Now, when we first opened the store in 2017, one of the young ladies who worked in there spilt some wine on the floor, and she was terribly worried because it was a new floor and it certainly, you know, left a sort of mark. And she said, well, what are we going to do? We're going to have to scrub it back. And I said, no, because in 10 years' time, it's just another part of the patina. And even the stickers, if you remember back to the pandemic, where we all had these stickers of, you know, keep 1 meter apart, yeah. whatever it might be, we had these stickers on the floor. When we peeled those stickers back, they left a sort of ghost of this circle.
Wow.
And Neil, who looks after our property maintenance, said, do you want me to clean them back? And I said, no, because in 20 years' time, that's another part of the story.
Yeah.
And all of these things where you hope to see things that get better over time, and perhaps that's a luxury of being a business that hopefully will operate out of the same space that it's operated out of for 325 years, for another 300 years, is that you can invest in things in a way that perhaps you wouldn't do if it wasn't your own space. But I'm a great believer that it doesn't become dusty. You know, there'd be a danger in a way of creating something which is that sort of traditional museum. And I see it sometimes with brands when they go down that route, and it always feels a bit of a wasted opportunity. The flip side is that when we create a new retail space, for example, we create it in a way that it feels progressive, but respectful of the tradition here. So for example, in the shops, we didn't want to create what we have in the reception here, which is very wonky, distorted floorboards. There's no straight lines in this building. And we thought, well, that's going to be a bit Disney if we try and recreate that next door. Why don't we use 100-year-old barrel staves and put them on the ceiling? So we sort of invert the space and we have history on the ceiling and the floor will wear in over time. And I think those little nuances and those little connections, even to the extent that the bell in the shop, the bell in the front, you might hear it occasionally in the podcast coming through. The bell in the shop here was made by the Whitechapel Foundry, who also made Big Ben and made the Liberty Bell, sadly no longer around. They closed down just before the pandemic. But one of the last jobs they did was creating the bell for the new shop, which is calibrated to exactly the same pitch and tone as the one here, because we wanted people who were walking into a new space to feel at home. So those sort of subtle nuances, I think, are probably, to my mind, the markers of luxury brands. There's an attention to detail and a genuine care about experience that perhaps brands that don't have the same level of permanence or the same ambition perhaps miss.
Perfect. Talk about craftsmanship.
Craftsmanship.
That's a perfect lead into. That is what it is, isn't it? What is craftsmanship? I mean, what does craftsmanship mean to you then?
I think craftsmanship for me, it's so easy to talk about it in the sense of wine and spirits.
Mm.
So in a way, we can almost sort of park that, because there is something which is beautifully handmade when it comes to wine and spirits, and the human intervention there, that attention to detail, the artistry, the mastery, I think is a huge part of what you're buying into as a brand. But I think also doing things the right way and thinking about the future. So I think that craftsmanship and heritage and luxury are all connected. They're all bedfellows. I think sometimes brands labor the craftsmanship a bit too much. I mean, there's a danger that you become a little bit less distinct if everyone's doing the same, you know, photography of the leather belt or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I do think that craft will always be an important part of luxury. Or I hope it is.
Yeah.
I think maybe luxury will have gone off-piste if it's not.
Yeah, I agree.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely agree. They're intertwined, aren't they?
They should be intertwined. At the minute they're not intertwined, I'd be questioning perhaps what we're paying for.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, your story around the idea of the preservation, you have experiences, so you're constantly sharing the interactions you have with the other vineyards, with your customers. All of that is about sharing in a very, it's a very specific way of preserving Berry Brothers and Rudd, which is centered on the customer.
Yeah, and I think that any luxury brand, any successful brand actually needs to be customer centric. And we listen to customers a lot. We're lucky because we see our customers a lot.
Yeah.
And our customers by and large are quite outspoken. You know, they'll tell us if they think we're not getting stuff right. But we, for example, when we look at the range in the shop, every day we have a shop report and we note down every request we've had. Now, some of them are, you know, slightly ridiculous requests or things that we would never perhaps sell. But we still note it all down. But over a period of time, whether it's over a week or a month or a quarter or a year, you start to see these trends of more and more interest in a particular area. So it might be Japanese whiskey, it might be wines from Greece, or it might be whatever it might be. Sometimes it's about formats, more and more people asking for half bottles rather than bottles. So that very much plays into the conversations that we're having. And of course, we have to trust our own expertise and our ability to curate as a business. But if you're constantly listening, and we have this wonderful opportunity with customers coming into the shop, but also into the cellars downstairs, and there's nothing better than sitting with, you know, three or four customers to hear what they think. And it's quite illuminating sometimes. You know, it terrifies me how many people I meet at the very upper echelons of businesses who don't spend enough time with their customers. And if you're making all your decisions in the boardroom rather than speaking to people that are actually buying your product or your brand, I think you're slightly doomed to make mistakes. Whereas I love hearing both the good and the bad from our customers. And some of it is about, you know, we have by default a supply and demand issue because there are certain things that we sell where there is very limited supply. And actually coming in with a large amount of money doesn't necessarily get you to the front of the queue. In fact, it doesn't. So that's probably not dissimilar to whether it's a Birkin bag in Hermes or whether it's a certain Ferrari. You know, you have to show loyalty and buy up through the range. What that means is that we're constantly playing with this dynamic of, in some ways, letting customers down because we can't give them everything they want. So it has to be a dialogue with your customer. I think that brands need to do it increasingly more now as digital becomes more important. More time speaking to customers is going to be helpful to everyone.
Well, that's interesting. So do you prioritize the loyal customer?
So it depends is the answer. But let's say you have a very limited supply of a certain product.
Yeah.
That would be offered on allocation.
Right.
And that would be offered to customers who have perhaps bought that particular wine, because that's what producers want to see as well, that they want someone who is going to have a wine that they have a genuine love for, ideally that they are opening and drinking themselves, and that is what a producer wants to see, is someone who is a passionate fan of their product. So from that respect, you know, some of these wines are produced in very, very finite qualities. So something like Chateau Lafite might be producing 20,000 cases a year, actually quite a lot. Someone like Domaine Romani Conti, probably the most famous Burgundy wine, can be producing their top wines in, you know, 400 bottles. So inevitably, there for certain products is significantly more demand. And we tend to do it based on the customers that have been with us for a long time. And not just loyalty, it's not necessarily about spend, because I think that that's probably slightly less comfortable, but a customer who has interacted with us on multiple levels. So someone who, for example, stores wine with us that has celebrated, you know, their anniversary or birthday downstairs in the cellars, who has come to some of our wine school events, who buys in spirits and wine, you know, the customers that we are closest to are inevitably the ones that we see the most. And those relationships, many of our customers are great friends. And the wine world is small, but you know, I suppose one of the great pleasures of this industry is that it is so conducive to, you know, breaking bread and sharing a bottle or having a glass. And, you know, we're very fortunate as two families that we sell something which is so enjoyable, rather than selling nuts and bolts or something which is maybe commercially interesting, but less emotionally interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. So with the, I mean, they're two very distinct wine markets, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's the collector's market who will buy, store them in temperature controlled rooms as an investment piece. And then you've got the client is going to consume, drink the wine.
So I think that often they are less distinct than that.
Right.
So we have, a focus absolutely on collectors, but by collectors, we don't necessarily mean investors. So for us, collectors are people who store wine for periods of time, knowing that they're buying them perhaps at release and are consuming them later.
Right.
Now, historically, there was always something which my grandfather would have referred to as a rolling cellar. So for example, if you bought two cases of something, it went up in value over time. You might sell one case and spend the earnings back into wine. So the idea was that you could build a modest cellar over time that involved a little bit of buying and selling. Also, I think your taste can change. I remember seeing a friend of mine recently who is very passionate about contemporary art, but he's embarrassed about the stuff that he bought in his 30s. And it's not that it's not good art, but it's not of his taste. He seems to think, I couldn't tell the difference between the new stuff and the old stuff, but he seems to think that the stuff that he bought originally is a little bit one-dimensional, let's say.
Yeah.
So he is selling the stuff that he bought originally, and he's reinvesting that money into things that he's collecting now. So that sense of collection, that sense of ownership over time, and we have a lot of wine in storage. We have you know, capacity in our warehouses in Hampshire for just over 14 million bottles.
Wow.
So a lot of our customers are keeping wine in perfect condition, because actually, going back to that sense of trust, if you are storing something with us often for 20, 25 years, perhaps even longer, you need to know that it's well stored and well looked after. Now, the joy for us is when someone takes it out of that cellar and enjoys it themselves. That's the sort of circle of life, as it were. But inevitably, you have customers who perhaps overbuy, they get enthusiastic. There's definitely a sense that customers sometimes have more wine than they can ever consume themselves.
Sure.
And that would give opportunity to sell a case here and sell a case there. But a lot of those customers are putting the earnings back into buying more wine for consumption.
Yeah.
So thinking of customers purely as investors, I think there are businesses, there are certainly businesses out there who are presenting wine as an investment, quite outspoken about that. I think it's a dangerous world to be getting into. It's not a regulated world. I think that if you are not buying wine for pleasure on some level, then perhaps you're missing the greatest part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, it's encouraging to know that people actually drink the wine. They don't only store it.
You'd hope so. You'd hope so. And where's the fun of it if you're not drinking it?
Well, exactly. I wanted to ask you about sustainability and regenerative farming.
Yeah.
And how that impacts on the business and what your views were on that, because it's becoming such an important part of our lives.
Hugely important. It's interesting. We are fortunate enough to have just been awarded the King's Royal Warrant. And what's interesting about that process, I'm the grantee of that warrant and have been through the process of applying for warrants in the past. The focus now from the palace on sustainability is really exciting. And quite simply, businesses that aren't doing everything they can to forward sustainable initiatives really will be falling behind. For us, I mean, we're a founding member of the Regenerative Viticulture Foundation. We believe that our job is not to convince our producers, because most of our producers are already on the journey. We're lucky that we work with, as I said, family businesses often who are thinking about next generation. But we can illuminate some of the topics that are surrounding that area and also connect people together as well. We also work with, for example, we distribute a really exciting whiskey called Fielden, which is a relatively new whiskey, an interesting brand to talk to as well. And they are passionate about heritage grains and regenerative farming from a spirits point of view, because they want real visibility of the grain that they are putting into their whiskies, because their belief is that quality comes not just from the barrel and the storage and the whiskey making, but also from the fields and the grains that it comes from in the first place. So they, if you look at their fields, rather than a sort of monoculture of grain at exactly the same height and exactly the same color, they have these wonderfully eclectic heights of grains and clover running through them and so on. So I think that for any family business that isn't thinking about sustainability in the future, I'd question how long they can really be viable for. Mm. Lizzie Rudd as well, who's our chair, I think it's probably fair to say to Lizzie that her legacy will be around sustainability. It's something that she's truly passionate about as well. But we also think it's good business. I mean, it's not just a case of us feeling that it's the right thing to do. I think that it will increasingly become a hygiene factor for brands. I think that there will be an expectation. So everything that we can do now to make sure that we're well positioned for that will stand us in good stead. And I genuinely just think it's going to be something that is normalized going forward for the top brands, that you would be utterly surprised if someone wasn't following those principles and being led in that way, and also being a mouthpiece for sustainable initiatives and so on.
Yeah. I mean, this might be a stupid question. Mm. Do pesticides impact on the taste of a wine?
That's a good question. So I suppose when people are using things like pesticides, it's normally about consistency. So for example, if you are being faced with something like mildew, for example, and remember, some farmers have tiny little crop holdings, and if your entire harvest is going to be wiped out, you know, there's a huge emotional tie there, and there's a commercial requirement there. I think looking at it the other direction, there is a movement which has been around for many years now, which is called biodynamics, which is using lots of quite extreme methods. So for example, famously, there's often planting of cow horns with manure and stuff like that. It's a little bit of homeopathic ideas in there as well. Whilst, you know, I'm yet to be entirely convinced that it is 100% scientific, what you can taste in the wine, I believe, is the attention to detail and the care. If someone truly cares, and if someone is working in a biodynamic way, they are passionate about the crops that they're producing. So I think you probably can taste it, but it's not necessarily through taint. It's much more through quality of product or end product.
What's your favorite wine?
My favorite wine?
Red wine.
It's a really good question. I'm incredibly fickle. So if I've been somewhere nice on holiday and I fall in love with a place, then for the next 3 months, I'm mad about Greek wine or Spanish wine or whatever it might be. But I'm also, I love wines with stories. So one of the joys of the wines that we have here, we have a family reserve downstairs, which has wines going back to the 1830s. And there's something very special about picking a bottle from there and knowing that that bottle has been stored in perfect condition here for 30, 40, 50 years. So any wine with a story, probably. And whiskey, I'm very partial, growing up in Scotland, a good whiskey as well, but I think I've never got stuck on one. I think that life would be a bit boring if you got stuck on one.
Very diplomatic, yeah. Okay. The nearly final question is around education.
Yeah.
Because you are creative director and director of experiences.
Yeah.
How important are the experiences? Because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it plays such an important part around educating a customer. So it's two-pronged, the question. One is, do you get people who know nothing about wine who are coming in? And do you get people who, customers who come in who might not even buy wine from you?
We've got a very broad church of customers who come in. We offer around 300 what we call events and education is the department, and the wine school, which is part of that, offers everything from an introduction to wine course, which is a proprietary 6-week course, where people can come in having never tried a glass of wine before and come out with, I think, a very rounded education about wine overall. You would be very confident to come in and into any restaurant and look at the wine list, or you'd have a really good understanding of what you like, which is the important thing of all of this. Now, equally, we go up to the other end of the scale where it might be that someone who has been a lifelong collector is interested in trying 3 different wines from one village in Burgundy. So there is a real scale. There's also great opportunity, and again, this is that idea of connecting producers and customers, is that we have lots of producers that come into market and are hosting dinners downstairs where you're not just trying wines often from their own personal cellars, but you also have the opportunity to talk to those producers about their story and the decisions that they've made along the way. So I think that, as with lots of topics, whilst the academic side can become a little bit stuffy if you're not careful, and it certainly shouldn't be delivered in any way that feels pretentious or exclusive or in any way exclusive to the detriment of people wanting to come and understand more, I do think that, as with so many things, a little bit of knowledge can enhance the experience, and a little bit of connection to the brand, to understanding their philosophy, the way that they make wine or spirits, can enhance the experience. So we're lucky. We do over 1,000 events a year here. We have lots of customers coming through, and they're such a varied bunch of people that we're learning as much from them as they are from us, I hope.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, 1,000 events a year, that's a lot of events.
It wasn't the plan.
Right. It wasn't the plan. But then that's proof, that
there's demand.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's demand. And we love seeing people here. And, it goes back to the place of having a spiritual home in St. James's here, is that we want people to come and see us. And you'll find, I'm surprised we haven't had it today, is often a tour group will come in and, do you mind if we pop in for a moment? And suddenly you've got a room full of, American tourists looking at the building itself. So, we love sharing it with people. We love showing people around.
Amazing. So, Geordie, as I always end the podcast, the final question is always, what is your luxury?
I actually had to think about this one a little bit. And perhaps the obvious answer, or perhaps what people might expect, is sitting in some fancy Michelin star restaurant enjoying some very expensive bottle of Bordeaux or Burgundy, but it probably isn't. I think that one of my great passions is the outdoors, is nature. I'm lucky enough with wine and spirits to be spending a lot of time out in vineyards and wonderful regions around the world. So it's probably hiking up a hill in Scotland and not enjoying a bottle of claret, but probably a flask of tea on top of a mountain, which perhaps doesn't sound very luxurious to some people, but for me is probably the perfect luxury.
Yeah, but that is the perfect luxury. Perfect way to end. Geordie Willis, thank you so much for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. We look forward to seeing you on the next one.